historic day.
That was the sound of rioters last Wednesday who, after having just attended President Donald Trump's nearby Stop the Steal rally, breached the United States Capitol by force in an effort to derail the vice president's ceremonial certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory over President Donald Trump. At least five people, including one Capitol Hill police officer, have died as a result of the melees, and the nation is careening yet again towards an impeachment proceeding of the 45th American president. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by leading Reason Lights, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi.
Hey, howdy. Matt. Could we really kind of breached the protocol by all shouting at once, Matt.
We're so excited to be on this pod today to talk about all the news that happened.
You know, like sometimes everyone just wants to jump into the place at once.
It's okay. Like a Who concert out here.
I haven't seen a crowd like this since I went to see the Who. Okay, we're going to dive into all that, including the ongoing great deplatforming debate in a hot minute. But before that hot minute, Bound by Oath. Is the name of a documentary podcast by our buddies at the Institute for Justice. The new season of said pod explores why it's so hard to sue government officials when they violate the Constitution, even when victims are demonstrably injured. Bound by Oath explores the issues of governmental immunities through stories of real people fighting to vindicate their rights, with interviews as well with the nation's foremost scholars and lawyers. Check out Bound by Oath on all of your friendly neighborhood podcast apps. You'll be glad you did. Okay, let's just jump into it. Catherine, even as we are speaking, the House is reportedly introducing a single article of impeachment on incitement of insurrection. It reads, in part, President Trump gravely endangered the security of the United States and its institutions of government. He threatened the integrity of the democratic system, interfered with a peaceful transition of power, and imperiled a co-equal branch of government. He thereby betrayed his trust as president to the manifest injury of the people of the United States, unquote. So the question, should the president be impeached on that article, and or should he be removed from office in the remaining 200 whatever hours we have left by invocation of the 25th Amendment?
So first, I have to say that article of impeachment is an awful lot more compelling than the last one we did. That's a real humdinger, and I appreciate its bluntness and directness. We don't got a lot of time to screw around here. At the same time, I do think the key words in it are peaceful transfer of power. My goal now and always is to maximize the chances of a peaceful transfer of power. Now, that horse is way out of the barn already at this point. It is galloping free in the hills. Five people are dead in an assault on the Capitol, explicitly designed to prevent electoral votes from being ratified, right? So this is, we now are not currently having a peaceful transfer of power. But I think there is still a chance for this to be more like an asterisk or a footnote or a kind of almost a news of the weird item than the thing that starts the tale of the end of American democracy. And so I think when you ask the question, should the president be impeached? I only care about that from the perspective of what makes it more likely that on Inauguration Day, he quietly leaves town, Joe Biden becomes president, and we never hear from him again. So I have like a very consequentialist view of this. I don't particularly think impeachment is the way that we reckon with his bad behavior here, because there is only 200 some hours left in his presidency. He's going to be booted regardless. The 25th Amendment stuff similarly seems kind of beside the point for that reason. But I think a big part of the peaceful transfer of power is not only does the handoff occur, what does the person leaving expect to happen to him? And this conversation we're having now, where maybe he gets impeached or criminal charges are brought against him after he is out of office, like that's how you get more Trumps, I think. And the thing I really don't want to have is more Trumps. The thing I really, really, really want to have is the closest we can get, given the mess that we've already made, to a peaceful transfer of power. I don't think doing an impeachment is necessarily going to preclude that, but I don't necessarily think it's going to make it more likely either. And that is my goal.
Suderman, the counter argument to that, or one of the counter arguments to that, would be that you should remove this as a possibility of future action. Like, there should be a consequence for this particular action. We don't want a future in which elections are contested in this manner, riots are organized in this matter, or stochastically, I don't know if that's pronounced correctly, probably not, encouraged in this manner. And also, second part of that counter argument is that when you impeach him, you block him in particular from ever running again. So what say you?
Yeah. So, I mean, just very personally and not as a kind of larger strategic, not from a larger strategic perspective, but I mean, get him out of there. He should not be president. He should never have been president. Yes, he was legitimately elected, but he should have been, some legal measure should have been used to remove him from the presidency as soon as possible, because this was always the risk. And it's, and this isn't different. It, what happened was different, but there was always this risk. And it's actually, you know, it's sort of in some ways surprising that it took this long. That said, I actually share Catherine's consequentialist view that like the wise and prudent thing here is to think about the future and what we want from it and how to get that. And what she wants is no more Trumps. But as you pointed out, Matt, one of the effects of impeachment, the impeachment process, can be a way to get rid of the Trump we already have. First, getting rid of him now, but also preventing him from running again in the future. And right now, as things stand, Donald Trump is the likely front runner and the likely nominee for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024. The party is still in many ways behind him. Certainly, there is no one who is able to compete with Donald Trump at this point. And if not Donald Trump, then Don Jr., then a member of the Trump family who seeks to carry on that tradition. And so so part of this is a question of how do we prevent this from happening again? And I think it's actually very unclear to me what the best way to proceed is, if that's your question. Like, I think there's a case for impeachment and a case against it, right? And I really don't know the answer. But I would say that the other thing we need to be thinking about is consequences and accountability, and democratic accountability, and the way that Congress, a co-equal branch of government, has to discipline the executive branch is impeachment. They don't have another mechanism, really. And the president encouraged a riot against Congress that resulted in people dying. Congress should respond somehow or another to that. The method by which the Constitution provides to respond is impeachment. And so I at least think that it's legitimate for Congress to be doing this.
Nick, grab one piece out of what's being discussed broadly, which is the word incitement, right? This impeachment article is about incitement. Jacob Solomon has written, I think persuasively, that by the Supreme Court's legal definition of incitement, this is not going to get there. So this is more like the plain definition of the word as it exists in English. So my question to you is, by that plain definition, do you think that what happened was incitement?
Yeah, I do. I think that Donald Trump's behavior in the past week is completely indefensible. I think it was a week ago I had said that, you know, the various actions that his administration had taken in terms of, you know, challenging in courts of law, having rallies and things like that, I thought were pathetic, but I didn't think they were, particularly awful in terms of, you know, they're not a threat to the republic. I don't even know that I believe this riot is a threat to, you know, the thin blue line, or whatever we want to call the line of between chaos and
I don't think we call it the thin blue line. Trump, I think that's something else.
Yeah, not anymore, right? And it became very confusing.
Yeah,
because
like the negative zone we're talking
riots,
about here.
Yeah, no, it's I understand. It's like beyond the bizarro world meets the negative world or something, and the counter earth. But it is, his behavior was indefensible on Wednesday, on Tuesday and Wednesday. There's a lot more to be said about all of that and other aspects of the government, including the DC government, all of that. Trump indefensible. I think he should leave office in some level beyond the pounding that he took at the election. I don't know. I would share Peter and Catherine's sense that what is more important is kind of a pragmatic question. And for me, it's not even how do we make sure Trump never wins again, or that Don Jr., or I'm sure there's a Donald Trey somewhere, you know, that we're going to be dealing with in a couple thousand years, how you keep them out of politics. It is to get him out of office, because I don't actually think he is a continuing threat to the stability of the country or to the seriousness of politics. And that's mostly because politics are screwed up enough on their own that they gave rise to him. I would like to think, an impeachment that gets rammed through in a week and a half or something is not going to, it's not going to heal the national wounds in any meaningful way. I think a better course of action is to make sure that he is nowhere near nuclear codes. And if he ever has been, like they can, that suitcase, the nuclear football. What are you talking about, Don? It's playoff time. You know, the NFL has the nuclear football. We don't know where it is right now.
I mean, as keep long away as he's from president, him. He has access to those codes.
Yes, obviously. But keep him away from that, censure him in the strongest terms possible, and get him out of office, and see how he disappears in the American culture. I think ultimately that is the best thing. We are left ultimately with a fascinating question of a disgraced former president who also got, a record number of votes. I mean, he got like the second most votes ever in presidential history, right, in an election. You need to think about how you dissipate relationship he has with his followers. Most, the vast majority of whom are not MAGAites or anything like that. But, that's a real question. But I think the short thing is he gets out, keep him away. He said he's not coming to the inauguration. Why not, move the inauguration up a couple of days and just close this out quicker?
Catherine, building on that a little bit, Republican Party voters chose this guy in 2016. It was a crowded field, arguably a crowded field with some pretty interesting people.
The deepest bench, Matt, I mean, the deepest bench since pick your favorite Lakers team. I mean, they were just
exactly.
It was,
I think, 1987, I don't know, just out of a hat. And they picked him despite him, escalating right down into our lives and immediately saying truly awful things and many things that were anti, what conservatives have stood for a really long time. Many elected Republicans, Mike Pence is among them, disavowed decades worth of their previous policy positions in order to ride the train with him. You had this past week, just before the riot on Capitol Hill, Republican attorneys general, people like maybe have some familiarity with the law, were sending out emails encouraging people to go to the Stop the Steal rally on, having to do with something that had been adjudicated quite many times, as Jacob Sullum has been painstakingly writing. And then even after a bloody riot, when there's blood still on the floor, a half a dozen senators, 121 congressmen voted not to certify the election. I know you're not a member of a political party and you don't like to vote and your heart is filled with hate. Is there not something malignant inside the Republican Party? Is this a party that's worthy of respect right now?
I mean, I don't mean to be that guy, but like there's something malignant inside the state. Like the Republican Party is doing a particularly good job of foregrounding the ways in which people grasp and cling to political power to the detriment of all that is good about them and their humanity, and that only people who leave have any chance to ever remain morally intact. The end. Like I don't mean to be a libertarian nihilist a la the Gillespie accusation of earlier, but I do think that this is a problem with the Republican Party. But I think moreover, it is a problem with politics, and it is a problem with governance, and that there's a slightly different alternate history where Wednesday wasn't violent, right? There's just, I mean, there's really some like very busy butterflies just like flapping the fuck out of their wings somewhere in a bunch of alternate timelines to prevent this. And in those timelines, the Gillespie semi-bullshit from last week is true. In those timelines, the system held. In those timelines, you know, everyone made their stupid speeches and everyone did their thousand legal challenges and everybody had to sit through a ton of grandstanding. And in the end, the institutions worked and we did the peaceful transfer of power peacefully. We almost managed that. And if we had, we would have felt like everything was okay. But the point is, everything is not okay. It was never okay. It's not okay because of Donald Trump, but it's also not okay because people shouldn't have this much power over other people that they feel the need to violently cling to it to the last second.
But I, Matt, if I can kind of elaborate on your question, or I want to make sure I understand what you're asking. You're saying there's a categorical difference within the Republican Party of and we're not talking about like, you know, rank and file people. We're talking about elected officials who, against all reality, all provability, all empirical reality, are saying this election was stolen. That's what they were saying when they continued to vote against the certification of the electoral votes that are, you know, constitutionally, the Congress doesn't get to peek inside the envelope. They just get to, you know, recite the number that's on the outside of it that the states send them. And you're saying I guess this is for Catherine, like when you say it's politics, is there an equivalent to that level of refusal to accept basic reality in the Democratic Party? Or is it an issue of politics, or is it that there's a third of the elected Republican officials in Washington, D.C., who have essentially said, I am insane. I am no longer doing basic reality testing. I think that's a serious question.
I agree. I think that's a fair question. And I do think, you know, in the last few months, Republicans in particular are truly standing up and setting themselves as an inglorious example of inappropriate, bad, and sometimes illegal behavior. But I do think, like, in a weird way, Republicans in 2016, along with Democrats in 2016, pioneered the messaging about stolen elections, right? Like, they market test it, right? They market tested a bunch of language and rationalizations and rhetoric around election malfeasance, failure, fraud, to kind of see how that would go, and then used the pilot program 2016 to really try it out in 2020. And Republicans clearly did it this time. But again, you know, no disrespect to Peter, who wants to retroactively impeach Donald Trump from his first day of office, but like that kind of talk from Democrats before he even took office. I mean, you remember there was the like impeach Trump stuff before he took office.
Mm-hmm. Don't let him take office.
It makes it harder for impeaching him now to have a punch, for instance, just as another place where some kind of norms and behaviors were eroded in a bipartisan way.
I would point out that during the media's, most of the media's very uncritical celebration of Stacey Abrams's role in the Georgia runoff victory for the Democrats, because she's from Georgia and had helped register and campaign for a lot of people. This was the coverage of that was coinciding with coverage of President Trump applying all kinds of just really inappropriate pressure on Georgia election officials.
Right, like
officials.
Remember that story?
These streams crossed. It was beautiful to watch. I forget, it was CNN or MSNBC. Stacey Abrams was on and they were, you know, offering her bouquets of flowers and then mentioning Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia, I think, Secretary of State. And she's like, oh, hold on there. Don't you say that Brad Raffensperger is a good man. He's actually a bad, because he's been resisting Donald Trump, because she still hasn't really conceded her election in 2018. So, yes, those streams cross. But I want to give Peter an opportunity, one last opportunity before we shift and start talking about the Democrat. Last
to
opportunity.
To speak ever again.
Generous of you.
To acknowledge that Trump won the election.
Yes, for once. No, I forget when you wrote this, Peter. Maybe it was 2016, maybe it was 2017. Maybe it was when I was being impeached. It's hard to say, but you wrote something with a headline that caused a lot of eye rolling among certain readers and listeners. It's all podcast with me now. But something along the lines of Donald Trump is a very bad man.
The headline was Donald Trump is a bad person. And it was a case for Trump being basically an authoritarian. And an argument that we should pay attention to his character, because his character was inherently authoritarian. And the way you could tell was that he was a piece of shit to everyone around him, but also because as a result of that, the guy just admires authoritarian impulses and has for decades. And, you know, he just constantly talks about when authoritarian governments see mobs come for the right, see like democratic protest mobs, and they put them down with strength. And they really had to use, you know, their big guns. And he's so, so excited by authoritarian power grabs. And this actually goes back to the question you were asking, Catherine, that I think is just sort of worth addressing. There is a specific problem with the Republican Party that is unique to the Republican Party right now. And that problem is not just Donald Trump, but the fealty that the party shows to him. Because that's what Trumpism is. It's a substitute for a political agenda. It is, right, it's a replacement for ideology, for policy, for even just kind of like basic political solutioneering. And it has filled a void in a party that has been toying with policy nihilism for years. You know, like several times over the past decade, I have written something to the effect of, you know, the current dynamic between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party is that it's a contest between no ideas and bad ideas, right? With Republicans having no ideas and Democrats having bad ideas. But now I think under Trump, and owing at least in part to Trump himself, it has become a contest between bad ideas from the Democrats and something that is turning much darker and much worse, a kind of populist authoritarianism, right? So think about this whole thing that we have witnessed over the last couple of months, the effort to overturn the election. It is based on lies, just lies and lies and lies, self-serving lies, right? Not honest misunderstandings, not confusion, just cynical bullshit. And they are lies explicitly designed to illegitimately preserve the political power of one man. That's it. They're not designed to further an agenda of any kind. It's just about preserving one person's political power. That is an authoritarian movement, which shouldn't surprise us because Trump has always been an authoritarian because he's a bad person.
Okay, victory lap, successfully run. That's it for you. Nick, there's a lot of kind of coalescing narrative storylining, I think, going on with what happened last Wednesday, including a lot of comparisons, I think maybe facile comparisons, but maybe you have a different view of it. Well, what would this look like had it been a Black Lives Matter protest? They were cracked down on by cops in a much more brutal way than the protesters were. Kamala Harris said something to that effect. What do you think are the uses, the drawbacks, and maybe even the benefits of making comparisons to what happened on Wednesday and the reaction to what happened on Wednesday to the what happened in the summer protests and riots and reaction thereof?
I think the best use of that is to recognize that we are in an era of political violence. And this isn't to draw equivalencies between each kind of riot or violent protest moment or anything like that. But the fact of the matter is, for the past year, at least, we've been in amped up political violence. We saw, you know, cities like Portland and Seattle. After the George Floyd video surfaced in Minneapolis, we had a summer of violent protests. And actually, it's wrong to call them violent protests. Most of the protests were not violent, but then people were kind of riding along with them and doing various types of things. There's an acceptance or an expectation of violence related to political grievance right now in America that I think has not been in fashion since the late 60s and early 70s. And it is extremely disturbing because the same arguments that get used to justify or wash away or wave away political violence in one circumstance can always come up again and again. And in the 60s, you know, people tend to forget because of the way they talk about the 60s, there was a huge amount of right-wing violence coming out of the Ku Klux Klan and the embers, the, you know, still smoldering embers of de jure segregation. That was matched on the left by things like the Weather Underground. And everybody knows the stat that in the early 70s, there was something like, you know, 3 bombings a day around the country. The Capitol was actually bombed by the Weather Underground at one point. These are really screwed up and difficult bad times, and they need to be confronted with a blanket condemnation of violence and that the grounds for violence, you know, because I assume if, you know, the Nazis invaded or Imperial Japan invaded American cities, we would not be saying, okay, this is a time to, you know, be peaceful and not push back. This, nothing that we have seen in American society over the past couple of years, you know, underwrites violence. But that's where we are. And we have had, for at least the past year, continuing arguments about the necessity or the obvious, you know, need or legitimation of violence. And I think that that's, you know, to me, that's a real problem, especially now that you have what, you know, Trump got, what, 74 million votes? Yeah. And, you know, if you figure at least half, maybe more, you know, let's say 60% of the people who voted for him were voting against Biden. There, you know, let's, I don't know, give him 10 million or 10% of his votes as, you know, actual MAGAites. You've still got millions of people who are in a fucked up headspace. And we need to figure out how to contain that, how to dissipate that, and also how to address it.
That's
out there. And we also have people from, you know, Black Lives Matter affiliated groups who are absolutely, you know, convinced, you know, that we are living in a white supremacist society in which if you are Black or a person of color, you have no legitimate way of addressing, having your grievances addressed. You know, we need to come up with ways how to either completely cordon off those people and keep them away from violent, you know, crowds, or we need to engage them and change their minds.
Speaking of cordoning off, there's been a lot of that going on since the riots of President Trump himself, supporters, some entire networks from social media in a private way, mostly not just social media, but also corporations like Citibank or Citicorp, whatever it's called these days, saying that they're no longer going to be allowing corporate donations to the Republicans who voted against certification and a bunch of other stuff like that. So let's use that as an opportunity to go to a listener email and a reminder, we are wanting to hear from you so that we can address your questions on the program. Send us emails to roundtable@reason.com, and please to include your name and or Twitter handle. This one is from Tim Orozco. It's kind of on point. Says, and I'll throw this to Catherine first, but we can discuss. While I don't disagree with Twitter banning Trump specifically, is it troubling to you how much power corporate tech giants like Google, Twitter, and Facebook, and might add also Amazon, control dissemination of information and can prevent specific viewpoints from being expressed? Have we reached a point where corporate censorship coming from these companies poses a bigger threat to freedom of speech than government censorship? Catherine Menge Ward.
There's a lot going on in that question, and I appreciate that it's more thoughtfully phrased than a lot of the other versions of that question that are getting bandied about out there. So thank you very much for our brilliant and excellent roundtable question askers. I think apparently I'm just doing keyword recognition in my answers today, because I think the keyword in that question is power. So, like, you know, the big difference in the question of the power that tech giants hold over our speech versus the power that the state holds over speech, once again, is the question of violence. And, you know, when Twitter, and not just Twitter, but as you say, like banks and other, you know, entities start to choose who they will do business with, I can see, I totally understand why that makes people uncomfortable. But I gotta say, like, if you don't think the baker has to bake the wedding cake, you don't think Twitter has to carry Donald Trump. Like, on some basic level, I do think we need to come back to that principle that if we don't want the state to be the entity that chooses who gets to speak on whose platform, who gets to use whose private property to speak, then this is the way it happens. And sometimes it's not going to happen quite right. Sometimes the calibration of where it's social shaming and where it's exclusion and where it's kind of cordoning off or forbidding certain types of interactions voluntarily, like that's how we make a better world. And I really get why this makes people nervous. Actually, interestingly, the ACLU kind of said almost the right thing about this week, which they
must have been drunk,
which was that they said, hey, you know, for months, Trump has been using social media to seed doubt about the results of the election and undermine the will of voters. We understand the desire to permanently suspend him now, but, and then they go on to say, basically, President Trump can turn to his press team or Fox News to communicate with the public, but others, like Black, Brown, and LGBTQ activists who have been censored by social media companies, will not have that luxury. So that, I think, is the place where I'm a little more concerned. Like, I'm not worried about Donald Trump being able to speak. He's going to be able to speak. In some ways, I'm not worried about anybody being able to speak because there are so many ways to get your voice out there. And I do think the idea of tech companies as monopolies is always misleading and misguided. But it's not people like Donald Trump who are ultimately going to be hurt if social media companies start shutting people down or if platforms start shutting people out. We're going to see what happened, for instance, with sex workers when Visa stopped doing business with Backpage and then eventually with other platforms. People with less power will have less voice. And I don't quite understand why that equation doesn't concern people more than when Donald Trump gets shut off.
Well, but do you...
Peter, one... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to follow up and ask Catherine, but isn't that really the question? You know, because once we throw open the idea, you know, it's all cakes and it's all gay wedding cakes. Let's take Donald Trump out of it and, you know, Instagram influencers or something. They'll be fine. There is a move, broadly speaking, to police and regulate speech much more tightly to what Matt refers to as the great deplatforming, which is happening. I think it is right to be deeply troubled, I mean, by that, and also to kind of force a discussion. Like, I agree with you, you know, in terms of libertarian dogma, I agree completely that companies should be free to do whatever they want. But I also want to argue with them that whatever they want to do should be much more wide open than currently is conceivable, because now it is, you know, we seem to be entering an era and maybe it will never really affect us. So, like, what do we worry? Or people who are somewhat normal, but, you know, there are more and more stories coming out of people being dispossessed of, you know, a presence on a particular platform, having a particular contract, a record contract or a book contract, because they said the wrong thing, because they attended the wrong event, things like that. I'm kind of, you know, like, I don't want to live in a world where it's like somebody is going to be going through everything that you do and say, oh, well, you know, you attended this, you watched this TV show a couple of years ago. I find that so offensive. Get the fuck off of my platform.
I just think that you have to pair a culture of free speech, Peter, with a culture of free association. And that means that Twitter can boot off anybody they want. I mean, I see what you're saying. Of course, I see what you're saying.
But they should.
That's
why
I'm disagreeing.
We're not questioning
with you.
That
that's
they can.
I actually think if you want a world where people speak to each other more civilly and engage in a better, more fruitful way, there are two mechanisms. One is people individually choose to be more civil and polite, and I would love to see that world. But another is that you create spaces for civil discussion, and that maybe Twitter could be such a space if they are allowed to aggressively police it. I don't know. They might screw it up. They probably will. But
the Chinese Communist Party has got no problem expressing their civil ideas about the Uyghurs on Twitter, right?
If the alternative is that people look to the state to solve this problem, that will be worse. And I do think your advocacy,
but it doesn't have to be,
the broad culture of free speech is taken by many people wrongly to be a call for state action. See the entire debate about Section 230 right now.
Let me build on that and throw it to Peter, which is to say the analogy of the gay wedding cake. I think some are saying, look, Amazon, Twitter, Apple, Google, it's a little bit different. Like I can walk, granted I live in a big city, but I can walk to a half a dozen bakeries from where I'm sitting right now. You cannot really walk to a half a dozen, can you? You know, web services companies. And it's, I mean, it's amazing how thoroughly places like Parler or Parlay just sort of get disappeared. And I would add another wrinkle to that in specifically, Parler had really awful kind of admin security. Not that I know what those words mean, but they've basically had their
shut up, Mister. My password is entire, password.
I have better passwords than that, at least.
It's totally 1, 2, 3, 4.
But
no, it's all baseball players from his childhood. I guarantee
that that is absolutely true. But no, people have been downloading all of the history of Parler, and there's going to be doxing, or at least just like, hey, this person said this thing on Parler. I have the receipts here now. And some people who are not at all important in the world are going to suffer as a consequence, including being perhaps barred from using social media. So since you have been very much on the Catherine side of the argument of this is good free speech, free association rights, and that's fine. What say you to those who say, look, it's just not the same analogy because there really is a narrower tube for people to go through? They at some point have to deal with these companies. And if those companies just all of a sudden, all of them say, nope, you people, your universe can't be here, that's not going to be a good thing for the culture.
So I think Catherine makes, you know, a good point about power. There's a huge difference between the kind of economic power that Facebook, Amazon, Google, big banks, et cetera, exert. They exert an awful lot of power, but that's obviously different, not just in scale, but in kind from state power. And we just need to be much, much, much more concerned about state power, which has the power of guns and the power to put you in jail. And to use those guns to put you in jail, much more so than we need to be concerned about Amazon not letting you use their web services. At the same time, the key word I want to introduce into this conversation.
Keywords.
We've had power, we've had culture, but the other word, which is a little like culture, is norms, right? And so I take really seriously concerns about political culture and free speech culture and social norms. And so just as congressmen acting like absolute asshats in ways that technically don't violate any constitutional provision or congressional rule can still totally degrade the institutions that they're working for, tech companies who are prominent actors in free speech culture need to understand that the culture of free speech and free expression is important as well. And just because it's legal to deplatform Parler, and just because it's celebrated in some quarters, doesn't necessarily make it wise. Now, on the other hand, there's a flip side of that, which is that the people who are engaging in free speech on those platforms also need to not act like asshats. And so I'm looking at some clips that were pulled from Parler here right now. And you've got Lynn Wood, for example, and a lawyer associated with the president and his effort to illegitimately overturn the election. And here's Lynn Wood parlering. I guess it's not tweeting. They let them in. Get the firing squads ready. Pence goes first. Here's somebody else who is not famous, but just like some rando on Parler. But this is the kind of thing that you see on it. Remember, all journalists are soft targets and are fair game in the coming revolution. Don't be afraid to take reporters down by any means necessary. And so another way of thinking about this is that everybody needs to just behave themselves and not act like an asshat. And I would actually bring in the Second Amendment here.
Ooh,
because if you hang out with gun culture people and with people who own guns, a thing that they are correctly, absolutely obsessed with is good trigger discipline. And good trigger discipline is there in part because it's just a sort of functional, practical safety thing. But it's also because if you see people acting out in bad and stupid ways that have even the tiniest and smallest chance of going wrong with guns, then what you are doing is degrading Second Amendment culture. You are behaving poorly in a way that makes you a jackass and makes you somebody who is going to need to be cast out from society in some way, probably private, right? What you're doing is you're threatening all of the people who are using that right responsibly. And so the asshats on Parler are doing stuff that threatens the people who are using free speech responsibly. And that doesn't mean it's illegal. That doesn't mean that the government needs to come for them with guns. But I do understand that there is going to be a negotiation here between the two sides, right? The platforms and the people on them. And in some ways, everybody just needs to behave themselves and stop acting like dicks.
Yeah.
I love how profane this podcast has been. I'm really here for it. I also want to say, though, I think Matt's analogy of I can just walk down my street and get a different cake. Like, that's the whole point of the internet. You can walk down the street and get a different place to speak.
Like, Trump can't.
I actually think even though big tech is big,
he could walk to the TV.
Right. So Trump Parler was that place, and that place has been shut down.
Yeah. Walk over to the Android store and try and download Parler
on the street and speak, for one thing, although I wouldn't advise that he do that just today. But he can also there's actually been a whole jokey discourse on Tumblr, yeah, if you remember Tumblr, and also on MySpace, both of which still exist, neither of which have banned Trump. Actually, MySpace might have, but Tumblr has not formally banned Trump. And it sounds like a joke. Like, Trump on Tumblr would be absolutely amazing. And I do want to note, I read a brief vignette about Trumbler. How Alex Jones got on Tumblr and was hounded off by individual Tumblr users. Like, there was no corporate decision. Every single person on Tumblr just made it so annoying for him to be there that he left, which is the real kind of crowdsourced censorship I want to talk about.
If we're going to end up in a world, though, where because people are unpopular, you make it really, really hard for them to, find a place on the internet that they can temporarily speak from.
But it's not really hard. That's what I'm saying. There are website, Trump.com. And then he can have his words on it.
Yeah. And then what about when, Amazon Web Services says, we're not hosting
there
that.
There are
and
other
Google
web hosts.
Google says, we're not hosting that. And
I mean, truly, rolling your eyes, but there are other web hosts.
Yeah. No, what I'm rolling my eyes about is Donald Trump is, pretends to be a billionaire. What about people who pretend
right.
to be a
well,
thousandaire?
Well, that's why I started.
And who are using dial-up, et cetera. And what I'm getting at is to, when we talk about, Peter talks about, most Second Amendment people, and it's stunning to me. I don't really give a shit about guns, but when I see the trigger discipline that these guys, manifest in, in all kinds of settings, and yet it's harder and harder to put anything on about guns on YouTube. And so you do what Reason does, and you put a gun videos on YouPorn or
it got taken down.
Pornhub. You make it, the more you make it difficult. Maybe it's strictly legal. It's certainly strictly legal. And maybe it's strictly politically correct from a dogmatic libertarian point of view. But what a shitty world, as opposed to saying, let's talk more openly and let's be a little bit looser and let's be a little bit more thick skinned so that you don't have to go to the equivalent on the internet, to the equivalent of that postage stamp sized free speech zone that we make fun of on college campuses. Let's have a world where people aren't such fucking idiots and heart attack cases and pearl clutchers that, you can just be a little bit looser in public view. I interviewed Alex Winter, who, released a documentary about Frank Zappa. And as a result, I was looking at, where free speech was in the 80s. And it was insane. I mean, people could not. I mean, Cyndi Lauper's song lyrics were being, discussed and analyzed in front of Al Gore and a Senate subcommittee. because she espoused dangerous views of masturbation. Satanism was everywhere. And but the state wasn't involved in that. The PMRC kept saying, like, we don't want the state to be involved. We just want to talk in front of the state. This is all, it gets very complicated, et cetera. Yesterday with my girlfriend and my kids, we listened to Ice-T's Cop Killer, Matt Welch, if you can remember how that...
Yeah.
You know, had the, you know, fucking United States public cultural sphere by the balls for like about 6 weeks. And we got to hear Charlton Heston do a dramatic reading of Cop Killer, you know, which ultimately maybe it's all worth it. But it's like that was such a dumb world to be in where everybody was trying to censor people mostly through private entities. And it's just like it's a better world to say, like, you know what? That's a dumb song. I don't want to hear it. I'm turning it off, as opposed to at the root level saying, that's a dumb song. I don't want to hear it. I want to punish the people who have that so that they have to go walk 1,000 miles in order to ply their trade.
I think one thing that we know for sure is that if you write a song with a name or a theme like Cop Killer, it's just basically an audition to play cops for the rest of your life on television shows.
Yeah, well, I mean, Ice-T is the real loser there. Yeah, he became
it's as if he played himself.
Version of himself. Yeah.
I'm going to stop Peter from talking because that's my favorite thing to do, but also because we've talked about that. This particular issue, which is great, and we're going to talk about it probably next week and the week after as well, because it's with us for the long haul. But I don't want this episode of this podcast to end without at least one question thrown at Catherine, but maybe a little bit more for all of us. Traumatic events like this usually lead to some kind of illiberal crackdown or overreach by the government. It is as old as rain, Catherine. So what, if anything, are you in particularly on the lookout for beyond, you know, the big tech, you know, authoritarianism, 1984, but like actually from the government? You and Peter both reference the people with guns are who we should be paying attention to. Okay, so in the wake of this, what are we worried about might happen? It might be discussed by politicians and law enforcement in order to tamp down on the real or suspected threats of the kind that we saw last week.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's going to be bad Section 230 reform. We will bracket that for now. But that, to be clear, will be an action of the state which will curtail speech. So if we're talking about censorship and we're talking about free speech, like what's going to happen in the end is that we're going to change the laws in a way that will make it harder to speak on the internet. So that I actually think is probably likely to be the biggest effect. But I want to note that when the state deplatforms people, this is what it looks like. They get put on the no-fly list. And the no-fly list is the worst tool. It was built out of garbage. It is the classic example of garbage in, garbage out. It's a list shoddily assembled of some people who are legitimately probably actual terrorists who would assassinate every member of Congress if they could, and also a bunch of people who, like, I don't know, you know, annoyed a TSA agent one time. And we are now talking about adding anyone who can be identified prior to any criminal trial or other proceedings from what happened on the Hill on Wednesday to the no-fly list. It is really hard to get off the no-fly list. And like, I don't know about y'all, but like all white people in a MAGA hat look the same to me. There is going to be some misidentifications. And like, we should not do that. We should not take a tool that emerged from the wreckage of 9/11 and was a mess from the beginning and use it to solve this problem. But we definitely will. So we are going to do that thing. And then I think, you know, the additional thing that we really need to watch out for is like a small thing in terms of the nation. But the Capitol Police are about to get both disciplined in annoying ways and have their funding probably doubled, and entering the Capitol will become impossible. And I don't know about you guys. You might have heard a little cynicism about state power from me in times past a couple of times, but walking into the Capitol is a genuinely moving experience. And when I was a kid growing up in DC, you could just walk into the Capitol. And I'm pretty sure that's over now. And that sucks because it's the people's house, et cetera, et cetera. and you really should have access to that building. Capitol Police were always... you know what? I'm not going to characterize the Capitol Police right now because they've had a tough week. But there are concerns about the way the Capitol Police have functioned in the past. I guarantee they will be doubling down on all of those things and keeping people away from contact with their representatives, which is not good either.
Fortress DC is going to be so irritating.
Yes.
Thank you, Catherine, for succinctly encapsulating. Go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say that, you know, as somebody who, unlike Peter, I was not walking on eggshells the entire Trump presidency because I thought it opened up certain possibilities, some of which took place in areas like school choice and whatnot. But the ultimate tally of the Trump presidency is one of, you know, just utter, utter awfulness. And it ended in a way that I think, you know, really underscores all of that. And arguably the worst thing that he has done, and I was looking back both at what I wrote about Trump when he first came into office, but when George Bush left office, saying that he not only destroyed the federal budget, but he destroyed the idea that government spending could be done wisely, effectively, efficiently, competently. I think Trump has jacked up the budget. The budget has risen insanely under him. He has expanded the idea. He has exploded the idea that government can ever be useful. And in a weird way, he has handed to Joe Biden and to the Democrats a absolute blank check that future generations will be struggling to cash for ever and ever. And, you know, Joe Biden is kind of, you know, he's been waiting to be president since 1988, and it usually doesn't work out this way, but he timed it perfectly because he has a 6 month to 2 year honeymoon where he will be able to do everything he wants, including pushing to get rid of the legislative filibuster in the Senate and things like that, and have free run of the place. And that ultimately is on Donald Trump and the Republican Party.
Let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the cultural arena. Peter Suderman, why don't you lead us
off? I just keep playing Cyberpunk 2077 because it's a video game, and video games are real long, guys. Like, I think I've probably told some of you this before, but for those of you who don't play, just sort of understand that the short path to the end of Cyberpunk 2077 is about 25 or 30 hours out of your life. And that's if you just rush through the bare minimum of doing stuff. And if you actually take time to explore the game and play all of these interesting side missions, which are sort of like, think of them as like chapters that you could skip in a really long novel, but are interesting little short stories kind of buried within it. And if you take the time to go play those, the game can easily take 60, 70, 80 hours to complete. There was a report early on before the game came out from the company that if you really wanted to experience it all, 175 hours, right? So it's like, is there a TV show that is comparable? I mean, I guess it's sort of like watching every episode of Star Trek The Next Generation or something. In any case, a bunch of the bugs have been cleaned up, at least on next-generation consoles. And one of the really interesting things about this is they've got a movie star in one of the major roles in the form of Keanu Reeves. And typically when that happens in a video game, the movie star plays a relatively limited role, kind of showing up at the beginning and then showing up at the end when the game is kind of over. And they have incorporated Reeves's character and his voice into the game just all throughout, even in like these tiny little kind of tertiary moments that don't really matter. And so you're on some like side mission to steal a thing for some guy, and it has no real relevance to the main plot. And it's just this sort of like third order, you know, not even like a secondary mission, right? It's just like one of these little gigs. And like Keanu Reeves will just, because he exists as a hologram in your head in the video game, will just like show up leaning against a dumpster, wearing a black tank top and sunglasses and leather pants. And it'd be like, so we're really doing this.
That was pretty good.
That's pretty
and it's just great.
It's incredible.
Great because it's just like having Keanu Reeves in your head all the time for however many dozen hours you play this stupid game.
Do you just have like entire dump trucks full of pot that just like show up in front of your house, Peter? Don't answer that question. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
Very on point for how this podcast has gone today. I watched a new Netflix series called The History of Swear Words, and it is narrated. The Keanu Reeves role in this Netflix miniseries is played by Nicolas Cage. So that's what's happening. The thing you're imagining right now is precisely what it is. It's Nicolas Cage in a sort of weird, like, you know, men's club library doing very cheesy intros about each of the key swear words. And then they do kind of a documentary style thing where they just like cut to a bunch of experts, comedians, whatever, to talk about the word. I will say the breakout hero is not Nicolas Cage, who frankly is deeply, deeply painful to watch in this, as he is in all things, but Corey Stamper, who is the lexicographer. She used to work for, or maybe still works for, Merriam-Webster, and she was, among other things, the person responsible for amending the entry for the word bitch to include that it was derogatory in like 2015. Which is an interesting factoid for you. Obviously, I like her largely because she is me and also has purple hair and is a lexicographer. And speaking of butterflies flapping their wings, there's an alternate universe just one tick over where we've swapped places. But the thing that's actually interesting about the series is that they handle many of the words that you would think of as the worst swears very, very lightly, and they handle the feminized swears, so such as the word bitch, with incredible trepidation. Like Nick Cage doing the opening monologue about the word bitch is him just being like, which is super interesting, right? The idea that in the evolution of bad words, we would now be more worried about implied sexism than we are about implied obscenity of other kinds. A super fascinating meta commentary in a series that is a commentary about the history of swear words.
Did you?
It's terrible. I don't actually recommend it exactly, but I do because it's short and it's Nicolas Cage and it's kind of cool.
Did you learn any new curse words?
They were not going for a wide net. They were focusing on the classics. So no.
Anyone who has not seen the YouTube compilation Nicolas Cage losing his shit, really, you need to Google those words right now and
it's
watch
important.
The video. It is possible. It's like certainly a top 10 thing on the internet ever, and maybe literally my single favorite thing the internet has ever given us. I wrote about it a little bit in a tribute to Nicolas Cage that I wrote when the movie Mandy came out a couple of years ago. So you can find it on Reason.com.
I do want to note in the episode on the word shit, they have Isaiah Whitlock, famous among other things for his role as Clay Davis in The Wire, doing his famous shit for like they literally have him do it for like a full hour and they just keep cutting back to him through the whole episode. And it's beautiful.
It's like the old Bud Light Super Bowl commercials. When everyone's just saying, what's up? Speaking of bitching stuff, Nick, what have you been consuming?
I watched a Netflix show that was directed or produced by Martin Scorsese and hosted by him, starring Fran Lebowitz, called Pretend It's a City. It's 7.5-hour-ish episodes of the humorist Fran Lebowitz, who has the most famous case of writer's block or writer's blockade, as she calls it, for the past 30 years or so. It is a Valentine to New York, to a kind of pre-pandemic New York, but even a kind of pre-internet New York. Lebowitz can be very funny, is very maddening from a kind of policy angle, but Like all great New Yorkers, originally came from New Jersey, from Morristown, New Jersey, and moved in the early 70s. And her attitude is refreshing and bracing on all sorts of things because she is both a New York liberal, but is also like a no bullshitter, an early closeted lesbian who then kind of came out, kind of didn't. Presaged so many things in American culture, especially a New York culture, which I was missing being in LA as I am. The one thing that I think gets back to something that Catherine was kind of suggesting, there's an episode where she talks about smoking and about how much she loves smoking and how great smoking is. And then she had a bit part in The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio. Again, this is also a very good use of Martin Scorsese. You can watch this unapologetically on a smartphone, I think. But she talks about wanting to smoke on the set of this Wolf of Wall Street, couldn't get it. Leonardo gave her an electronic cigarette, a vape pen. And she talked about how vaping is good, like it takes away the murderous edge, but it's not a, you know, it's not a cigarette. And she complained about not being able to smoke anymore, et cetera. They have this little colloquy. And then at the very end of that episode, there was a warning saying Leonardo DiCaprio and Fran Lebowitz do not support the use of vaping products. And smoking is like, you know, smoking is bad for you, even vape products. And it's just kind of like, you know, I mean, it's a shame that Lenny Bruce isn't around where he would greet everybody at the end of a show like the way Penn and Teller do as they're leaving the stage, you know, as they're leaving the theater and say, no, really, I didn't mean anything by it. I really didn't mean anything by it. I don't believe anything I say to get a joke. But pretend it's a city. It's a good 3.5 hour tour of a city that doesn't quite exist right now. It may come back when the coma is, when the medically induced coma is ended, but also a sensibility that is very quickly kind of fading from America.
I just shudder to imagine what kind of disclaimers are going to be put, if they haven't been put already, on that Jim Jarmusch's Smoke, which was, I recall as being a very fun ad hoc New York Valentine to smoking cigarettes from 10, 15 years ago. I consumed something that was even foreshadowed almost by Nick, unsurprisingly. So as some of you know, I've been immersed in the music and music trivia almost of 1989, the calendar year, for my own dark purposes, and making playlists on Spotify. And I finally made it to December and put out a word on Twitter for people to encourage me to find things. And a person on Twitter said, you have to look up the Electric Eels, who Nick snorting with recognition over here, who had a record come out then called Having a Philosophical Investigation with the Electric Eels, which is a very funny title considering what kind of music they are. It was a 14-year-old record in 1989. This was a sort of proto pre-punk band, kind of in the Iggy and the Stooges genre, scabrous. They played 5 shows live. They kept getting deplatformed because they do stuff like, you know, they would have like Nazi insignias. They were always getting in fights. They brought like not chainsaws, but various industrial tools on stage. They sound totally like awful human beings. And it's great. It's just like really loud, ugly, 3-chord rock music from Cleveland, Ohio, from the early mid 70s. Super fun. It energizes you. A lot of the guys in that band went on to places like Cramps and Pear Ubu, or however that's pronounced. Yeah. And a bunch of
other
stuff.
They scared the Dead Boys. That's how weird and wonderful they were.
Yeah. Which takes a lot.
From back when the Midwest was like a hub of great rock and roll, which hasn't been true for a long time.
Matt, yes, do you think that the beauty of those moments, and this is, you know, truly rancid, horrible, nihilistic, you know, fatalistic stuff, is the beauty is that it can only last for a very brief period of time? Or, what do you do with that? Are you going to introduce your kids to that?
The kids, you know, they introduce themselves to things.
In a Gigi Allen phase, so you can't really can reach do them so right much. Now.
No, I don't really look at it like that. Nick, like biography matters to me less, although it's interesting, it's fun, than just the impact of a song itself. They have a song called Jaguar Ride. And it's just a great, like, you know, cocky, without at all having earned the cockiness, defiant kind of rock song. And yeah, I mean, you hear, I forget the name of the band, in Seattle, like in the late 60s, like called the Sonics, maybe. I might be getting that wrong, but it's very similar. Again, the Stooges are similar too. Just like people were out there kind of discovering and inventing punk without knowing it. In California, it was garage rock. It's just really kind of like propulsion, and energy. And like it sticks with you, just like listening to Raw Power by the Stooges right now. You listen to it right even now and you'll just go, wow, like there's a jolt of energy through it that doesn't depend on the biography for me, but it can, doesn't prevent other people from consuming it in that way. And that's all the consumption we have time for right now, because I gotta go. But thank you. Yes. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable. Again, keep sending us our your emails that we can read at roundtable@reason.com. Listen to all of our podcast offerings that this wonderful organization puts forward at reason.com/podcasts. This includes the interview with Nick Gillespie, the Reason interview, and also Soho Forum, etc. And if we can make it until next week, we shall see you then. Goodbye.